everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. Today, we are recording episode 175, and welcome to the conversation. Today is February 10th, and we are here in Canada, and my guest of honor is in Dubai. What a quite the difference. It's got minus 25 outside degrees Celsius, and in Dubai, probably it's much warmer than that. Let's start with the weather, which is the easy part of the conversation. And my guest of honor, allow me to introduce you, Chris, and I'll let you introduce yourself in a second. But Chris Adams, Chris is a known podcaster out there. He hosts a podcast called Muhammi, which is the Arabic word for lawyer. And Chris is specialized in marketing for law firms located in Dubai. He's Australian by origin, but he is located now in Dubai, and he has a business in Dubai. And we can't wait to get to know Chris a little bit on a personal level, get to know what he does and how he helps his customers. And then we'll tackle all these subjects. Chris, welcome to the conversation.
Thanks, Robin. Thank you so much for having me. Number 175. That's a really impressive number. Congratulations.
Yeah, you know, I was trying to figure it out, the amount of conversations that I've been having lately. And it's incredible, like, how I started with hope. And that's all I had, a hope, when I started 2.5 years ago. And I was hoping, like, somebody actually would watch some of my video or download some of my podcast. Literally, I was hoping, like, maybe 10 views. And that, I thought that was a success. Now it's taken off from there. And I really appreciate guests such as yourself, Chris, for joining me and making the conversation on this podcast a lot better.
The honor is all mine.
You do what I do. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. And I hope to one day make it to the level you're at, Robin. It's, really fantastic.
Now, on this channel, Chris, everybody gets an easy answer to start with, and I'm fascinated by the answers that I get to this question. And that's why I keep asking it, because I didn't want to change the format of this question, because it gives me such an insight, or gives the audience such an insight to the actual individual we're talking about. And, like, what we're known for on this channel is get to know the individual first and then get to know what they do after. Individuals are more important to me and to the audience, who they are, first, before we start getting to know what they do. So what's your story? What got you here?
What got me? Well, that's a big question. I guess, well, how far back do you want me to go? I was born in 1982 in Sydney, Australia. And grew up there in Sydney for a few years, moved to Canberra, the capital of Australia, which not many people know is the capital. But moved there when I was 4 years old. Canberra is quite a quiet place in many ways. In fact, most Australians say it's a pretty boring city. But actually, it's a great place to grow up because it's quite safe. It's easy to get around. And, like, from the age of 8, I was pretty much able to just ride my bike everywhere. We've got bike paths everywhere. You have to cross a few roads, but it's, you know, as long as you're sensible, you're pretty safe. So that growing up, it's like growing up in a big country town where you have that freedom, but with the city facilities. So I really like that. It gets a bit boring once you hit adulthood, to be honest. But, you know, it works for most people who live there and grow up and understand. So, yeah, really enjoyed that freedom from being a kid. It's better than having a car where you can ride about on your push bike and you go everywhere through the bush, try and avoid some snakes and, you know, ride up and down hills and just go play video games with your mates. It's hard to complain. So life took me from there. I grew up in Canberra. I was there till I finished school there. I did university there. I studied a Bachelor of Communications in Public Relations and a Bachelor of Laws, but I never really wanted to be a lawyer, so, or an attorney. So I, at the end of that time at school, I was sick of studying. Basically, I went straight from preschool to primary school, elementary school, as they call it in the US. I don't know what they call it in Canada. And then through high school and college and university and, you know, what was it like? Between 5 and 23, I was studying. So all I knew at the end of that is I did not want to study anymore. So I moved over to London. And basically that is because I had the travel bug. When I was at university, obviously, the seasons are the opposite way around in the southern hemisphere. What are they over in the north? One Australian summer holidays, which is obviously when we get the longer university college break. I went to West Virginia and worked at a ski field for a few months and worked in the call center there and tried to learn to ski and was pretty hopeless at it. The next year, I went to Key Largo in the Florida Keys and worked at a place called Ocean Reef Club where basically, people had more dollars than cents. George Bush Sr. had a holiday house there, and my job was to do room service and drive around on the golf cart and deliver food to people. So the first year in West Virginia, I made quite a lot of money because there was nothing to do. There was nothing to spend your money on when you're on the mountain and you're stuck there. It was quite tough mentally, but, you know, and the second year I had absolutely no money, but I had a great time and met a lot of cool people. So anyway, I had the travel bug. So that's why I think after university, I moved to London.
And then what happened after London? What took you from London to Dubai? How did you go through that transformation?
So it's a bit ironic and a bit funny, but when I moved to London, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And one of the law firms there asked me to join their business development team. And so I did. And then I was doing that for a little while. And then I, after that, met this nice young lady. Ironically, it's quite a funny story. I'd just been traveling for a few months. I'd been in Greece doing some volunteer work with sea turtles, which is another story. But I'd just come back, and one of my best friends from Australia was in London, and he was actually having like a farewell. And he was seeing this girl that I had never met before, so I introduced her, and she brought along one of her best friends. That turned out to be my now wife, which is quite funny. So, and those two actually broke up that night, and Monica and I met. It was quite fun from that time. What's also quite ironic, so she's an Australian. So we went to the other side of the world to meet each other. And we also met in quite a well-known Australian chain of bars. Actually, they don't exist anymore in London, called the Walkabout. So met another Aussie on the other side of the world, an Aussie bar. It was quite funny. So my time in London extended from my original plan of 12, 18 months into 7 years because she wanted to stay and we were enjoying it. And then her job took us to Singapore for 18 months or so, and then she got transferred to Dubai in 2014. That is the way we ended up in the UAE.
So for those who don't know you, Chris, what is it that you do now? What business are you in? What services do you offer?
To give you a bit of context and background for it to make sense to you and the audience, Robin. So as I said, when I moved to London, I was doing some legal secretarial work, floating around, good holiday work. And then one of the teams asked me to join the business development and marketing team. So I did. And that's pretty much what I've been doing roughly ever since. And
so that was the common thread, do you mean?
Yeah, so it's, and BD marketing in professional services, especially in law firms, is a little bit different to what most people think when they think marketing or business development. The marketing bit is, I guess, has a common thread to what other marketeers do. But the business development side is really helping senior lawyers who are gone from being pure lawyers into partners and effectively into business, being business people. And they're not really trained to be business people. And so they need quite a lot of support. Now, that's what the BD marketing team's role is, essentially, to the business development side. The sales bit really still has to be that lawyer, that senior lawyer, that senior accountant, if you're an accountant, if it's that senior professional. But our job is to help them to be that salesperson, that marketing person. We can't help them manage their team, but we can work with their team on the BD marketing initiatives. But the idea is to help them to really grow their business, to improve relationships with their existing clients, grow business with their existing clients, and to get new ones on board, and to really profile themselves, because nobody wants to work with a lawyer or an attorney until they absolutely need to. It's a distressed purchase, as it's been called. And so our job is to... Yeah, exactly. So that's our job. And so we use every bit of the marketing, traditional marketing, digital marketing toolkit we can, and then also sort of BD and marketing techniques, BD sales techniques to help them be the best salespeople they can. So I did that in London, in Singapore, in Dubai, in Abu Dhabi. And then a few years ago, I started CJA Consulting. So essentially, I'm a strategic advisor to professional services organizations, and I help them where growth has stopped for some reason. Usually it's a choke point because the founder has got too much on their plate. Like most business leaders, you know, as you progress, you grow the business and you have success, but everything's a lot of it's on your shoulders and you don't have the team to give it to, or you don't have the resources to, or you just don't know how to prioritize enough to, with all these ideas in your head. So that's my job, is to come in and give clarity. So I work with professionals to get clarity.
That's what you help your customers with?
Yeah, law firms, accountancy firms, doctors, anyone who's in professional services.
Anybody is in professional services, not necessarily just law firms. Mm-hmm. Now, when somebody listening to this conversation and, you know, immediately like me, I think the first question comes to mind is, look, I mean, lawyers, doctors, etc., why do they need to sell? Like, why do they need to market themselves? Isn't it enough just to say, you know, here's my office, here's my sign, I'm a lawyer, if you need me, come to see me, kind of thing? Or why do they need to push that extra mile and sell themselves? Like, is there, you know, I think there is a soft way of doing this and there's a hard way of doing it, right? So I'm assuming lawyers, doctors, et cetera, and professional services in general, they prefer the soft selling approach, evidence-based sales, versus, you know, your hunter who goes out, knock on door, ask for the opportunity, that kind of thing. That's normal commodity or normal services selling kind of thing. So where do you stand on that whole thing? Do I need a salesperson? Do I need marketing as a professional? I thought it's enough just to hang a sign up there.
It can be if you've got a really, really good network already and you've come from a really strong base, but the majority of people haven't, and there's a lot of competition out there.
Okay.
And so there are very few and far between professionals who can just do it without marketing or without doing some sort of business development at all. Mm-hmm. And actually, they will have done something throughout their careers. The only exceptions you'll get, I think, is if someone's already really well known as an author or as a lawyer or as a doctor or whatever, and their reputation precedes them, so they're already in demand. But that means they've, at some point in time, they've done the hard work to get to that point. For the most, they've got some loyal clients, they've built up patients or clients over time, and those act as nice referrers and collaborators. Essentially, you still need to be able to be found. So, you know, you could trust me implicitly, Robin, and say to me, Chris, I've got this legal issue. You know, I've got a great opportunity. This guy wants to buy my podcast, and he wants to buy it for, you know, $1 million, and I think it's great. But what do I do? Do you know someone who can help me do it? And I will point you in the direction of the right lawyers who can do it, because you couldn't do it yourself. You wouldn't know what the value is necessarily of your podcast, mm-hmm. and you probably wouldn't know who to go to. So I guess the process you take yourself through is you'd ask someone you trusted, or you ask a number of people you trusted. They'd probably all give you different answers. And, you know, I might say, go to Joe, and someone else would say, go to Joette or whatever. So you would have those choices, and then you have to go and do your due diligence to work out who you're going to go with. And you want to go to someone who's really credible, you know, who knows what they're talking about, and that's going to get you the best deal and advocate for you. And the way you're going to do that probably is you're going to ask people, and you've got to look online. And if that lawyer or solicitor or whoever it is can't be found, then you're probably not going to go with them. And it's also probably going to reflect quite badly on the person who referred you as well. So I think that's where the importance comes in, no matter what, is when someone wants to find you, has a need, they need to be able to find you.
Now, when you started, Chris, as you mentioned earlier, you've been through in and out, sort of speak, between, you know, depends on the country that you were in. You were in and out of the legal sector. So you either worked in some capacity in a way that, you know, that goes back to your days of schooling, when you went to university and you studied the topic. So you couldn't steer away from that subject. You've always been involved in it in a variety of market sectors, the UK, Australia, Asia, Middle East, etc. In your opinion, you know, when you look back, what stayed consistent about law firms and how they grow, and what completely broke down when the market moved or things have changed or they didn't have a chance anymore?
I think one thing that stays consistent is law firms need clients. No matter what, it's the only way to make money is to have clients. And
it's funny, it's in every business, right? if you don't have any clients.
I mean, your service is your product, right? If you put it in those terms, your service, your professional advice as a lawyer, as a law firm with a bunch of lawyers, is the product. So you need to have strong people, and you need to have reputable people, and in order to get clients, which is what's going to pay the bills. So I think that's pretty much what it all comes down to. And yeah, I guess
it doesn't matter which market you're in. It doesn't matter. Matter which country you're in, you always have the same issues.
Exactly. And you need to be credible for the type of advice that someone's looking for. You need to be able to, you know, if someone wants the podcast example, you know, where you're going to sell your podcast and make millions of dollars, you need to go to someone who's a corporate lawyer. Going to a real estate lawyer is not going to do you any good. So that's the key, is to be clear about, you know, the service you are professional in and best at.
Yeah. Like in your profession right now, I guess the question becomes, do law firms understand that they need business development? Do you have to convince them?
It depends. Some are very commercial and very pragmatic. And commercials, by the way, commercials are a word that lawyers absolutely hate. But it's because it's a little bit vague, but it doesn't necessarily mean money either. But you have to be quite commercial and quite pragmatic about it to be a really effective business owner. Effectively, you are a business owner. When you're senior in any company or in any professional services company, you're a business owner or have a stake in the business. A partner in a law firm, a partner in a accounting firm literally is a partner in the business, literally has a stake. So there is quite a few people out there, especially in the larger firms, who see anything other than fee earners, which is, you know, lawyers, paralegals, whatever, anyone who doesn't earn money as a cost to the business, as an expense, as a hit on the bottom line. Maybe that's true if it's not managed well, but if the business is managed well, those departments, HR, IT, marketing and BD, the firm cannot operate without those people. It just absolutely cannot. Who's going to employ the staff for you without an HR team? Who's going to, you know, keep the staff trained? Who's going to help you do your BD marketing when you want to be, you know, your job is to look after the clients, your job is to be a lawyer. Without the BD marketing support to respond to the complex tenders, to help you market yourself, help you be found, you're going to be lost. Same with the finance teams. Clients can't pay the bills. You can't issue bills.
Now, when we talk about marketing for professional services, and let's pick on legal for now, is there a difference between visibility and credibility, or do you try to market both or one with the other kind of thing? Or you try to crystallize both, I guess.
Again, I think it's about knowing your target audience. And that is probably one of the biggest difficulties that lawyers and professionals have, is going to way, way, way too broad and trying to be the best for everybody when you actually need to narrow down and work out who your ideal client is. So credibility versus visibility is an interesting one. You can be very, very, very visible and not credible, because if you're not talking about the right things to the right people, then you've absolutely got no credibility and no one's going to go to a professional for that. I always use the analogy of going to the doctor. You don't go to the doctor and go and talk to the BD person and, you know, the BD person says, okay, I'm here to see you, Robin, now pull down your pants. You know, you want to see the doctor. Talk about your deepest, darkest medical challenges, you're going to want to talk to the doctor. Same with talking to a lawyer. You don't want to talk to the BD marketing team. But you also want to talk to someone who knows what they're talking about and is an expert in that area. So, you know, the doctor analogy, if you've got a pain in your eye, you don't want to go and talk to a foot doctor. So I think that is the key. These experts, these professionals, we trust them with our businesses. We trust them with our lives in many cases. We trust them with our health and our families. And so without credibility, you are nothing, really.
You know what, Chris? Many professions, they suffer from that, right? So there's that lowest cost denominator that everybody chases versus, you know, are you good at what you do from a professional perspective, right? So I worked in the language industry, still I'm in the language industry for the past 23, 24 years. And professional translators, they study like lawyers, they go to university. Some of them are lawyers. They go to university, they study, you know, the linguistic side of academia, if you will. And they always, now with commoditization, everything is getting commoditized, right? You can become a lawyer on ChatGPT in no time. And so, you know, every profession is being targeted that way. And the biggest thing that we talked about for the past 20, 23 years is comparing translators to any other profession. And not just, you know, this, my point is not just the lawyers who are going through identification of my credibility and I deserve the rate that I'm asking for. Many professions out there are asking for those. But there's always those lawyers or those translators that they're willing to take a lower rate, which sabotage the entire business model for the rest of the professions. So how do you balance all this?
I think with great difficulty. If I think about the Dubai market, for example, there are just past 4 million people population in Dubai. So it's grown substantially. But there are close to 200 law firms here, various sizes. But in fact, sorry, it's 200 international level quality level law firms here, let alone all the much, much smaller ones. There are thousands of those. It's not really a big enough market to serve, to host all those law firms, all those lawyers. if you go to an international quality law firm, you're generally going to get pretty similar level advice from all of them. They're all very well trained. They were very, very experienced. They might give you slightly different opinions, which is why you always need to get more than one view if you have a legal issue. But it's very difficult to stand out from the others, because really you are very similar. It's relationships that make you stand out, the way you get your credibility out there that makes you stand out. Referral networks and collaborators are the difference. Word of mouth is the difference. But if you go to two international quality lawyers in Dubai who do pretty much the same thing, you're going to get very high quality advice, which is probably not going to be that much different in quality.
In the legal industry, what I noticed, and forgive me for my limited knowledge on the topic because I'm not as close to it as you are, but just from living in a Western world, in a Western country like Canada, for instance, I find in the legal industry is generally driven by complex policies, complex laws that requires you to navigate these laws using lawyers. And there's a high demand for that. That's why anytime a new law is passed, we have in Toronto something called Bay Street. Bay Street, I don't know what would be the equivalent in Dubai. There's where all the lawyers, the accountants, the financial guys, that's where they hang out. And on Bay Street, I think there'll be in every bar, there will be a celebration because it's cha-ching kind of moment, right? So okay. We'll get some money guys coming in. I don't know. Can you describe the situation? Like, what is it like in Dubai from that aspect?
Well, DIFC, Dubai International Financial Center, is probably the equivalent of the street you just mentioned. Within that area of it's a free zone, so for those who are not that clear with how things work in the UAE and in some other parts of the Middle East, a free zone effectively is almost like a different jurisdiction. And in fact, it is a different jurisdiction to what the mainland law is. So where Sharia law and civil law, Egyptian civil law effectively is the rule of law, the governing law in the mainland UAE, mainland Dubai, Abu Dhabi, in the free zone, it's governed by its own laws, which broadly comply with the Sharia law. They are hand in hand. But we have common law. DRC, we have common law. So it's much like the systems in Canada, the UK, Australia. And so precedents occur and all that sort of stuff. So let's try to go back to what your question was, actually.
Well, the question is, does the society or the government or whoever they are, the governing bodies, impose or create new laws that drives law firms' business? Or is it just generally strictly coming from corporates either moving or interacting inside of Dubai, which, it's got a lot of prosperity obviously attached to it, because I hear a lot of people are moving, establishing business in Dubai, but that help, I guess, strictly from a legal, not maybe help for the individuals, but for the law firms, generally comes from how many policies are you working?
Yes. So, so the reason I started to mention different jurisdictions is because there are different laws. Basically, you could go drive just outside the DIFC, which is bigger than a square mile, like you get in London, but it's outside the DIFC and you're back to mainland law, and the company laws are different. The dispute laws are different. We're talking about common law versus civil law. And so there's that massive difference first to deal with. And the thing is, so in places like Australia and Canada, when a law is made by a government, it takes time, and you can see it coming. It goes through both houses of parliament, unless it's a real, real emergency, right? But even then, the news will tell you all about it. You'll know what's coming. Here, you can wake up one morning and the law is completely changed. It happened to us a few years ago when we worked Sunday to Thursday weeks, like the rest of the Arab world. It must have been end of 2022, I think, that on the 21st of December, we woke up and the government said, government of Dubai had said, or the UAE government, in fact, had said, from the 1st of January, i.e. 10 days away, we're going to be working Monday to Friday weeks like the rest of the world. That's 10 days to make massive, massive adjustments, which obviously doesn't just affect, you going to work. It affects childcare, it affects education, it affects HR policies, it affects laws. So the point is, laws can be made very, very quickly. So it's quite a big mix of opportunities here, I suppose, in the UAE and the Middle East, because the civil law, the Egyptian civil code, it's in Arabic. You have to speak Arabic or be able to read Arabic very well to interpret it. And we rely on, if you can't speak Arabic or read Arabic, then you have to rely on official interpretations or unofficial interpretations through a third party. and keep up with that really quickly. That's very difficult.
So how's your Arabic coming along?
Not so well. Not so well. Funnily enough, in Dubai, you don't really need it. In Abu Dhabi, maybe you need it a little bit more. And definitely in Saudi, you need it. But it's bad. But it's bad that I just don't know that much Arabic. My kids know way more Arabic than me because they're required to learn it at school. It's a very useful language to know. But yeah, so the point is, I guess, Robin, that laws change very quickly on civil law. Common law changed a little more slowly, but in ADGM and DIFC, but there is an ample opportunity for business for lawyers, put it that way.
So a question on the actual services that you do, does digital marketing still deliver what you're supposed to deliver for those, for your customers, for your law firms that you work with? And how do you deal with things like the technical things like SEO, point per click, pay-per-click, PPCs, and social credibility infrastructure, thought leadership programs? Do you develop any of these services for your clients?
All of them, really. But the key is, Robin, I always tell my clients, let's start with the strategy first. Let's look at a SWOT, basically. Let's look at where you've come from as a business or as a person, if you're the practice leader. Let's look at where you want to get to. Let's look at who your opponents are, the weakness, the threats. Who are your threats? Who are you competing against? And where are your weaknesses? And then let's look at ideal clients. Let's look at who you actually want to target and ideal collaborators as well, who you want to collaborate with, who is going to help you facilitate to get the introductions, to get more work. Once we've done that analysis, then we have a clear path forward. We can make a 90-day or a 12-month plan of where you want to go. And that's when we start looking at digital marketing or traditional marketing, because if you jump in straight away and just start doing something random on TikTok or something random on LinkedIn, you may be talking to your target market, but you're probably not. You're probably going to waste a ton of time and a ton of money and not get much work if you're not targeting the right person or the right people in the right company, even if they're companies, the right people in the companies as well. It's not always going to be the C-suite, depending on what business you do. So the strategy is really important before you move to any of the tools, I would call them, like the digital marketing tools. We work on them all, but it's not the first port of call. And if it's the first port of call for you, then I'm not the right person to deal with you.
Now, you've seen some of your customers, you've seen a lot of cases out there or use cases of your services. What separates, in your opinion, lawyers with thought leadership that converts versus those who just publish noise? What makes the conversion, if you will?
So it's, again, very much knowing your target market, knowing your ideal client, your ideal
who you're publishing for, is that it?
Exactly. So back to your question about the digital. So there are people out here, lawyers out here, who are all over TikTok and get a lot of work on TikTok, but they're talking about very B2C kind of stuff. They're talking about, this is how you don't get stuck in jail. This is how you get out. This is how you don't get a speeding fine. You know, it's you know, the TikToks and stuff like that work quite well for that. And you can get a lot of popularity, but that's, if that's your business model and that's the kind of work you want to do, then that's great. But there's a specific lawyer I'm thinking of who does a lot of that. And he has a massive audience, but he doesn't do that work. That's not the work he does. He does corporate law. He works work with businesses. So yeah, he's getting a lot of profile, but he's not really
converting,
getting the profile from the right. And maybe he's, I don't know his business, but you know, there's no such thing as bad news, right? There's no such thing as bad publicity. But I would hazard to guess that he loses some credibility by being mass market and going publicly to his audience than to the business audience that he actually needs to make money. And he'd be spending a lot of time and effort on that. Yeah, he might be famous and influencer or whatever, but it's probably not bringing him the right caliber of work.
Now, you have a podcast, Mohammy Podcast, and you've been recording episodes. I was the lucky guest on your show a couple of weeks ago now. And I really enjoyed our conversation, by the way. I got to, for the audience, I got to tell my upbringing story, and I got Chris bored with my, you know, Civil War stories and how I got to Canada. I think.
Fascinating, to be honest.
I won't be back on his show. Probably he'd say, I've had enough with you.
I'm getting you back. I'm sorry. I'm going to get you back, Robin. I was absolutely fascinated.
I really appreciate having me on the show. I would really appreciate your podcast and the opportunity to tell the story. I don't talk about it often, but that was a good time. Now, in your opinion, somebody, like, there's this whole podcasting thing, is everybody's on it now and everybody wants to do podcasts. And I see a lot of that out there. It's a way to tell the story, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's an absolutely authentic way to get your opinions out, to get your ideas out. And it's relatively, relatively cheap to do. I mean, I hate to use the word cheap because you're still putting a lot of your effort in it, a lot of your time and energy in it. But you don't need a lot of infrastructure for it. I mean, you get a few things, tools, software, etc., and you've got a podcast. Initially, what problem did you personally run into that made Mohami podcast is the solution for that problem? What did you set out to solve with
it? There's a few angles to that. If I think about it from a personal point of view, from a selfish is the wrong word, but from a actual wanting to build my business out point of view, I am a professional effectively, like the clients that I work with. And the best way to get business is through word of mouth. But you also need to use all the tools at your disposal. So you need social media, you need video, you need audio, you need written content. You also need very strong relationships because that is the absolute best way is through referrals. So you need to have your name out there and be seen as credible. So from my own personal branding and business branding point of view, that was a big motivator for starting Mohami Matters. And it is called Mohami Matters versus CJA Consulting, which is my main consultancy business. So, there was that. But I guess the other part of it is that, well, there's a few other parts, but I really, really enjoy doing it. It is, as you say, I guess monetary, it doesn't cost a lot, but it is very time, way more time consuming than I'd ever anticipated, but it's rewarding at the same time. But it is also, I learn a lot. I talk to some really interesting people and I learn so much in every episode that I host, genuinely. And at the other end of it, I'm helping people because I'm helping the listeners to get some really informed information, really good information that's hopefully going to help them in their business, whether they're a partner in a firm or they're a solopreneur. But it also helps the guests at the end of the day. The guests get to talk about what they do, get across their expertise, and prove their credibility, which is very difficult to find another medium that does that as well. Plus the fact, but you do a podcast and you can reuse this content across so many different channels. So I think it's a slow burn, but it pays off, I think.
Absolutely. Now, in your opinion, at this stage of your podcast, I want to call it cycle, is Mohami a marketplace, a trust layer, or something else entirely? I get the learning part and education on both sides, the guests, self, and the audience. Do you trust layer is, I think it's a little bit, it hits home a little bit for me, because once you start validating, and it doesn't happen overnight. It happened to me too. When I first started, I had no idea what I was doing. I was just pushing content out. Of course, I had like a lot of good guests talking to me and indulged me with my first few episodes. They volunteered. Now, the first episode, I'm thinking, how in the heck do I convince somebody to come and record a podcast with me? But anyway, it worked. Thank them wholeheartedly. They're still on the podcast. Once in a while, they pop up. But that trust is a very, very valid factor, in my opinion. I don't know what your opinion on it.
I agree. And the guests that I have on are generally not performing. They are being themselves.
100%.
And so when you listen to them or watch them, there's no, pardon my friend, there's no BS. They are who they are. And so, if you like them, if you learn, like what they're saying and you like how they're saying it, then you trust them, I think. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, you don't. And I think that's a great thing about podcasts is they're very genuine.
And so let's shift a little bit and talk about AI, because it's in everybody's business now. And, and it doesn't matter if you're B2C or B2B marketing or sales or whatever you're in, it doesn't matter what profession you're in, AI is in everything. Where does AI genuinely help lawyers in your opinion today, and where does it create false confidence?
So there's a lot of legal tech solutions out there. Some are fantastic, some are just getting off the ground. Some are hugely expensive. The biggest ones you get, the global players, what I have noticed a lot.
Do you help them navigate all this, Chris? Do you help them navigate all this?
Yeah, if that's a business concern for them, for sure. But there are, I guess what I was, is a few strings to that. Some of the big global players have started buying up the smaller ones. So the market's getting smaller. I guess there's a bigger gap between the smaller ones with really good ideas and the massive ones. And there's not a whole lot in the middle. So for lawyers, for firms buying these products, there's a lot of choice, but at the same time, you're going to be paying a lot for a very proven product. So there's that. You think as a business, you think, well, that's expensive, especially if it's charged per head, per user. And then how's that actually going to help me run my practice better? And again, you've got to think about a business versus the actual legal advice. You've got the technical advice you've got to give. So you've got a lot of products that can help you as a law firm or as an accountancy firm or whatever to run better, to be more productive as a business side. But you've also at the same time got those that can help lawyers to produce contracts more quickly or automate contracts or help automate research. So it's a little bit of a minefield. There are a lot of opportunities, but I think there are also a lot of potential time to waste experimenting with different things. The other effect of it, I guess, it is having anecdotally what I'm hearing is that some of the more junior positions are being automated increasingly. So I don't know what the qualification system is like in Canada, but say in the UK, for example, you've got to go to university, you've got to get your law degree, then you've got to do a 2-year rotation trainee contract, which you've got to apply for and get approved for. You get paid for, but you are the bottom of the rung and you're rotating around 4 different departments and learning your craft. And then you become an associate and then you're just learning your craft even more. What I'm hearing is a lot of those more junior roles, the junior associates, the paralegals, the ones who would at least do a lot of photocopying and that are being replaced by automated tools, which is great for efficiency, great for business, but not so good for learning the trade. There was an Australian law firm partner actually that I was at an event with last year, and she stood up in a massive international firm and she's like, what we're finding is the trainee lawyers or the very junior lawyers are using AI for their research a lot and to helping to draft their advice, which is on one hand fine because it's more efficient, but they're actually not learning. They don't have a choice but to trust what comes out at them. So they're not learning what's right and what's wrong. It's only one message. So whereas before they would have gone to books, they would have done their research and they would have then, you know, run it off a slightly more senior lawyer who would have said, no, you're wrong. And then you don't make that mistake again. Now, nobody knows what's true and what's not in some cases, because it is just if you put rubbish in, you get rubbish out. But even if you put good stuff in, sometimes you get rubbish out because, you know, AI does tend to hallucinate and things like that. So that is probably a slight cost, I think, is they're going to have to find the balance between making sure there's still people learning and training and able to be the future leaders in law firms and future senior, and that the bottom and middle don't just disappear and be completely without training.
You know, I posted something on LinkedIn not too long ago, yesterday, I think it was, about course correction. So a lot of people have, you know, including Salesforce and a few other major companies, they have rushed into the AI hype, I would call it, and fired a whole bunch of people for the sake of automation. And now they're regretting it, including, that's not me saying that, that's their CEO saying it in a public statement. And they're trying to find how to get these people back on. These human assets with all the intellectual knowledge that they currently have, if it walks out of the door, you're going to rely on some agentic AI system that pretends to know what that individual that you just let go out of the door. And I don't think this is possible. And the reason I don't think it's possible, because there's no way yet to take all of our memories, encapsulate them into a technology yet. I hear this is coming in 2030. Remains to be seen with advance in quantum computing. Hopefully that would be the case. But this is crazy to see that, you know, first thing, CEOs in large firms, as you would call them in your world, say, okay, we've got a few automation tools, you know, 50% of the staff leaves. And then now what? Yeah, you know, one side what we need to talk about on this one, and thank you for bringing it up, Chris, is that intellectual knowledge that you currently have to train somebody, to bring them up the rank, to become senior. Well, you lose that because you don't have that anymore. So now what you do is, what are you doing? You're pushing that knowledge back to academia, saying, I want that individual when you graduate out of university, ready to go in front of the judge and debate a large court case in your world, right? So I'm thinking, before we get into a life and death scenario, God forbid, in front of a judge somewhere, let's put them through a little bit baby steps. Let's get them to defend a speeding ticket. It makes sense. Absolutely sense what you just said.
I completely agree with you. And so, yeah, to your point. So I think, is AI going to replace lawyers? Not yet, I don't think. yes, it can do the contract automation, that sort of stuff. Yes, definitely can replace some of the junior lawyers from that point of view. But a little bit like definitely going to a lawyer, maybe it's a little bit like going to a doctor or an accountant, but it's not black and white. Going to a specialist doctor or a specialist lawyer is not black and white. And I said, as I mentioned before, you know, you could go to two equally qualified, very good lawyers in Dubai, for example, and you'll get very good quality advice, but they'll probably give you two slightly different interpretations. AI is not able to do that. All it knows is what's gone in. It doesn't have life experience. It only knows at the moment what's been fed to it and what it's learned. And it's learned a lot, but at the moment it can't do that. I can't think of the word, but that interpretation to really, you know, give an individual opinion that's really well informed, but also shaped to the unique issue that potential client has. And interestingly, you mentioned before languages and translation. So with my website, Mohami, I spoke to a friend of mine who works with cultural intelligence and training people on cultural intelligence in the Middle East. Something with Arabs, basically, because the culture is very different from where we come in Western worlds. Different ways of doing business, very relationship driven, and just different ways of doing business. So I said to her, look, I really would like Mohami, which is at the moment all in English, you know, written by real lawyers, not AI. It's real lawyers, qualified lawyers, better than all. And, you know, how can we get this into Arabic? Because obviously that opens our market right up. We can go to Saudi Arabia, for example, and which is a lot more difficult to do in English at the moment. You know what? You can't just use Google Translate. You can't use just a translation, because she was explaining to me that it's not a literal interpretation. Writing something in English, a paragraph about a law or about a commercial concern, you can't translate that literally. It's going to mean not going to make sense in Arabic. There's a different meaning. There's so many different words in Arabic for one word in English. And so you can't just replace people with systems at the moment until there's a massive, massive improvement. You have to have that intelligence. You have to have that EQ, I guess, and that cultural intelligence to be able to, for example, to be efficient and replace a person.
You know, I use this comparison on this conversation, on this podcast before. I'm just going to use it just to have to add some laughter to the conversation this morning. I compare AI to a family who owns a nice looking car. It's in the driveway, and you've got a 14-year-old teenager who's eager to drive it. And you give him the key, and he drives that car, and he wrecks the neighborhood. At this point, this is where we are with AI. I don't think, and the reason I say that, I'm a tech person by background. I told you that on the podcast. You know, I've done my career in the technology, then I moved on to the language industry. From what I know and from what I've done research on, from what I work on every day, I still write my own programs. I feel like right now, when people say, you know, AI is hallucinating, technology is hallucinating, A, it's always an operator error. It's always how we're feeding the data in, and people are lazy. And that's another one I discovered throughout this entire process. When they are training a model, nobody is taking the time. What they're doing basically is they're grabbing the data and they're shoving it into an AI model. Well, hang on a second now. Some of that data, it doesn't work anymore. Some of that data expired. Some of the data is wrong. It's false. And you're feeding false information in a lot of cases to a model that you're going to rely on when there is a critical decision to be made, when a critical data to be announced. So just in case for the lawyers out there, we take an entire library of your case laws and we feed it to AI. Well, some of those case laws probably don't practice. Some of them don't exist anymore. Some of them laws have been passed since those case laws that makes those case laws null and void. How are you going to do that? AI is going to reply to whatever data you gave it.
Yep. So and who's fed it that data? Who's fed it that data of the old? I mean, who's gone and said this law of 2005 has been replaced by this law of 2020? If it's not a lawyer who's done that, the AI ain't going to know.
No. And this is where humans are, in my opinion, are so eager to, you know, automate and save cost and et cetera. I just got invited to a human AI conference working side by side in San Francisco. And I'll be attending that one at the Adobe head office in San Francisco coming up in April. And I can't wait to get there, because the entire conversation I've been having on this channel is deploy technology sensitively, deploy technology ethically. Think about what you're doing in terms of where you are to deploy this technology. Very useful technology. No, don't get me wrong. But if we deploy it in a fast, speedy way, eager to get things done because the boss told me so, I think it's going to fail. And it will fail miserably.
Yeah.
You know, I got PhD guests on this channel. You know, I'm going to get him back in again. Sydney Shapiro out of University of Alberta, University of Calgary. He teaches AI to postdoctoral candidates. And, you know, it's pretty clear. It's all in the marketing. We called it intelligence. Sorry, I get on a tirade on this one, but it's such an interesting topic. People are calling it data vectoring and data indexing. I specialize in data. So when you index a table, then you make it easy for creating a pattern, pattern recognition. That's what it is. It's indexing the data and pattern recognition. That's where we are right now. We're not at a point where we can take, let's say, a junior lawyer and say, we got to replace you with AI now. That intellectual content that this individual hold in their brain, there is no way you can replace that. I'm sorry. No way.
I agree. And they've also got to have learned that intellectual content as well. And that's where the danger is at the moment, because they're learning from AI a lot. They're not learning from experienced people as much as they used to. So it's the danger. It's a real danger. I always think of, Robin, when I was speaking, I was thinking about that, you know, that old saying that's probably been around for 20 odd years is, don't believe everything you read on the internet. Well, don't believe. And where do you think, where do people think that most of this data is coming from? Obviously, some is coming from encyclopedias and well-written books and all that sort of thing, and well-researched tomes, but a lot of it's coming from the internet.
Right.
And there's a lot of people who put a lot of fake information on the internet, whether it's intentional or not.
That's right. That's right. And when you go to Google search, it doesn't recognize if it's, you know, if it's correct or not correct. It's going to serve whoever better have a better SEO out there. And the SEO question, I had somebody coming online here and they're talking about, he's got this lady out of Washington. She owns Brandy.ai. And we talked about, her name is Leah. You can look it up on the podcast. We're talking about geo versus SEO. Geo is the ability for people to find you using AI as a search engine versus Google. This is where the world is going, to get validated, to get recognized in AI. Do you do some of that in your business?
I do, but I actually, in fact, on one of my recent podcast episodes, it hasn't come out yet, I spoke to two people who do this as a day-to-day business for law firms, and they're well worth having a chat to. They're from a company called ICVM Hawk. But it is a very interesting piece of work, a very interesting field. And they're kind of fighting a bit of an uphill battle, to be honest, because people don't understand it. But what I've seen from my own website, from Ohami, is that whereas a year ago, a lot of the traffic would be from Google and a little less from Bing, now it is from the LLMs, it's from the Perplexities, it's from the ChatGPTs, the Groks, whatever it may be. And if you think about the way you use it, that most people use it. I remember doing an AI course 18 months ago, and I was like, I haven't used ChatGPT today. And the instructor was going, how can you have not used ChatGPT today? If you don't understand you need to use it every minute of the day, basically, you're not doing it right. And I was like, I just haven't. 18 months later, I basically do use it every hour. I touch it every hour almost, or one of the LLMs. So I rely on it very heavily. But Yeah, you don't know what's under the surface. And I know it makes mistakes because I see it. If you're not paying enough attention, in one conversation, it forgets what we've talked about at the beginning. So 100%. It's a lovely tool, but you very much have to be the driver and be on it. But yes, in answer to your question, what I've definitely seen through Mohami is GEO. There's other things it's called are increasingly important because that's the way I'm using it. I'm now, you know, rather than going to Google and saying, what are the rules of football, or what are the, I don't know much about Super Bowl, so what are the rules of gridiron? I would do that probably not in Google anymore when I'll get 20 results and 50 million pages. Instead, I'll use it in one of the LLMs and it'll give me an answer where it's, you know, pulled everything together and give me almost like a story, a book. And then it said, now, what would you like to know about scrimmages or something, you know? So that's the way people are searching. I mean, and why wouldn't you search? So it's very relevant to professional services, Robin, as you probably, maybe that's why you asked the question, but you know, if you want to know something about a law, you're probably not going to Google what is the pensions law or something like that. You're going to say a real world problem that you have, and maybe it's employment. Say my employer's fired me. Instead of Googling and saying, oh, what are the unfair dismissal laws, you'd be saying, my employer fired me. I live in Dubai and they fired me and they did this, they did that. You give it the whole story and it'll give you an answer. So EEO is very important, I think, and it's the way forward for especially for anyone who gives their expertise as a service. Absolutely need to be on top of it.
Yeah, for the audience, Geo, I forgot to mention what Geo stands for. We know what SEO stands for, search engine optimization. Geo is generative engine optimization. And that's the future. I hear from everybody around that Geo will replace eventually the search engine itself. Like, so Google is the most visited website right now for search, but that's going to go away over time because people are seeking a lot more intelligence, and intelligence is going to come in from actually using generative AI as a search engine. So if you want your company to be found, let's say in whatever model that you're happy to use or you're using currently, and you value how your business is positioned in those generative AI models, then what you need to do is you need to use a service or ask somebody like Chris and his team to find you or help you through GEO representation in those engines. So that's the future. If you want to be represented in the future, a company show up in these generative engines, that's exactly what you need to do. Let's, if you don't mind, Chris, let's pivot a little bit. I tend to love this topic and I love to talk about it. So I don't want to take too much time from your day today. I know it's 6 o'clock somewhere in Dubai right now. It's approaching 7 o'clock, I think it's.
Yep, I'm enjoying the conversation. So I'm here for you.
I appreciate your time. Thank you. So what's the one thing law firm leaders right now should stop doing tomorrow? They're doing it now and they should stop doing it tomorrow, in your opinion.
I was going to say cutting costs. I think they need to start thinking like business people and less like lawyers. I think that this is a very wide net to cast, a very big generalization, but there are a lot of senior leaders at law firms who are lawyers and have grown up being lawyers and come up through the system. Yes, that has its strengths because you tend to know a little bit more about what clients want and, you know, what the laws are and how lawyers think. But that doesn't make you a great business person necessarily. And I think there is great strength in recruiting laterally and bringing in, you know, CTOs, for example, if we're talking about AI and new technology, bring in CTOs that are not necessarily experienced in the field of law or in other professional services that can think a bit more laterally and come at it from a different angle. Same with marketing and BD. Same with operations almost as well, is bring business expertise into your business. All these professional services companies, big or small, are businesses at the end of the day. They're there to make money. And so I think that's probably the biggest mistake, is constantly promoting lawyers to be the people running the firm and holding the business. And, you know, and lawyers also, by the way, they don't like to spend money. They really don't like to spend money. So they're not always that commercially astute.
I would assume in Dubai, they probably like to spend it on Mercedes. I don't know, but what do I know?
It depends who you are. Some of it's for show. Some of it's genuine. Yeah, they would love to. But there's a lot of people with debt here as well. Yeah, it's yeah. So
when you're in Rome, I guess, right? When you're in Rome?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, keeping up with the Joneses is a massive thing here. And a lot of people just struggle with that. I would say Dubai, the UAE, is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful place to live. And it's got much fewer problems in many ways than other parts of the world. But don't just rush out here without a job. Don't rush out here without a really solid plan and financial backing, because it is very popular. And it is I say, very high energy, high... you work hard. You work very hard.
Yeah.
There's more work than life, I would say, for many, many people. And keeping up with the Joneses is a common thing.
Keep up with the Joneses. I thought this is just a North American thing, but Dubai has it too now.
Keep up with the Habibis.
I guess here we do it at a different level. Like, I know, I noticed my neighbor got a brand new lawnmower. So we bought a brand new lawnmower. We're not into the Ferraris yet. I have no idea why. We should get into it.
My friend just got a Cybertruck. And at first I was very jealous, and he let me have a drive, wonderful to drive. But then I saw his wife driving the other day. I was like, yeah, pretty glad we didn't get one of those. It does really, really stand out. You want attention if you have a Cybertruck. It's a pyramid on wheels. Very fast,
yeah,
very nice. But
on the highway here, it looks so unappealing, but I hear people love them. So I don't know.
I drove it around the block. It was very nice to drive. How it turns on a dime. It's amazing. But yeah, you want to be someone who likes attention, I think, if you're driving some of these cars.
If you don't mind, as we close this conversation, what would you like the key takeaway for our audience to be from this conversation?
I think to think about your business as a business. Think about there's help out there if you need it. It can be very, very difficult being an employee. It comes with its own challenges, but it can be very difficult being someone senior in business with a lot of responsibility. And, you know, if you're a little bit lost with technology, with marketing, with sales, with what to do next, with so many options on the board, there's help out there. And you should use the help that's available to you. I can obviously help with people who are stuck. Robin, you're very good with podcasting, very well with podcasting. You're very obviously good at what you do with your training, and you're bringing technology into sales and bringing technology into helping people to run their businesses better, right? And there are experts out there that you can utilize that you should. You don't have to be the jack of all trades. So I think know your clients, know who you're targeting, shape your services towards that, and bring in expertise when you have a bit of a weak spot. Recognize that weakness and bring in some help.
And where can people follow you, Chris, and how do they get in touch with you?
So you can come to cjaconsult.com for the consulting. I'm all over Instagram and YouTube and everywhere. Mohami is mohami.ae, and Mohami, again, Mohami Matters podcast link is available there, and we're on. You'll see Robin very shortly all over Instagram and TikTok and YouTube as well, with all his pearls of wisdom.
I really appreciate it, Chris. Thank you so much. And also, if somebody wants to get a hold of Chris on LinkedIn, his name is Christopher Adams, and he's connected to me. So if some of the audience can't find Chris, please search me out, ask me for an introduction. I'll be happy to make an introduction for you.
It's a semi-common name, unfortunately. Fortunately or unfortunately.
Yeah. So, I mean, to identify which Chris Adams you're going to be talking to, look for the one who's connected to Robin.
And, yeah, that's the one. Go find Robin. Robin Ayoub is far easier to find.
Unfortunately, Robin and Ayoub in the same name, it's not common at all. And, you know, I don't want to take you back to my podcast, but I can remember my days back in school when I was the only Robin in the Middle East, and I got so teased like crazy. People asked me if I changed my names after I left. I said, no, I didn't. This is the exact name I was born in. People don't believe it.
Maybe not Lebanon, but a lot of other parts of the Middle East. Most people are called Ahmed or Muhammad. So Robin is a great name to have, in my opinion.
I really appreciate your time with me, Chris. Thank you so much for being with me. Any last comments? I
appreciate you having me along. Thank you, Robin.
Thanks so much for the listener. I really appreciate you listening into this conversation. I had fun with it. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as well. And if you're coming on YouTube, thank you so much for watching us. If you're coming on the audio channels, your favorite streaming podcast channels, thanks so much for listening in. And I highly encourage you to subscribe to our blog post, robinayoub.blog, where I summarize all these conversations. If somebody doesn't have enough time to listen to the entire conversation, you can read it through. You can read through it in less than 2-3 minutes. I summarize the conversation, put it on a blog post for you. And also, don't forget to check out our short videos, where I produce 20 to 30 short videos per episode. I put them on YouTube. Those are smaller consumable content pieces for each episode that you can reference. You can check out, listen to 2-3 minutes each, and some of them are less than 1 minute each. It gives you a bit of wisdom that you're looking for throughout this conversation. Thanks again for everybody for listening in, and I'll see you at the next episode. Take care.